From the Carver Center for Public Radio, this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda. The 21st Annual Washington Regional Gala, an evening of Arkansas country music, featuring Joe Nichols and special guest Back Road Anthem, is Tuesday, April 8th at Walton Arts Center in Fayetteville. Tickets and details are available at 443-5600 or waltonartscenter.org.
Ahead on Ozarks, Becca Martin Brown from Northwest Arkansas Newspapers gives us a big list of St. Patrick's Day events, and we have a preview of the William S. Paley Collection at Crystal Bridges.
We also learn about the latest plans for the new high school in Bentonville. And in a few minutes, our regular conversation about the week's news with Michael Tilley from thecitywire.com.
First, the Arkansas Forestry Commission is asking property owners to take precautions to help prevent wildfires. Joe Fox, a state forester for the commission, says with milder weather, many residents could be inclined to burn trash or debris. But he notes windy conditions and low humidity could make things dangerous.
March is by far our most dangerous wildfire month in Arkansas. So this is a dangerous time with fronts passing. We haven't experienced the green up yet in the state. So we have a lot of dry grass and leaves on the ground.
Fox says anyone doing outdoor burning should be extremely careful and not leave the fire unattended. He says it's important to have appropriate tools, like rakes and shovels, and adequate water on hand to ensure the fire doesn't spread.
The Pulaski County Elections Commission and County Clerk's Office are taking the Arkansas Board of Election Commissioners to court over rules for absentee ballots under the new voter ID law. The act does not allow absentee voters who failed to include ID extra time to present it, but it does allow in-person voters casting provisional ballots an additional week to show ID. The state board is being sued over its attempt to fix the situation. It drafted and passed rules granting absentee voters more time to present ID. County Clerk Larry Crane argues the state board doesn't have the authority to do that, only the legislature.
They had the opportunity to deal with it during this last session and chose not to. They had the opportunity to deal with it before the final bill was voted on and then signed into law, and they have chosen not to do that.
Crane says the law must be enforced as written, meaning absentee ballots without ID should not be counted and no additional time should be given. But the director of the state board, Justin Clay, says ambiguity in the law justifies the rule creation.
We have a statute that gives our board rulemaking authority to ensure fair and orderly election procedures, so that's the justification for the rule.
The case could be heard by Judge Tim Fox within the next 2 weeks.
A new report on children's health in Arkansas pinpoints successes and challenges the state faces. The report was compiled by a partnership of healthcare providers, state agencies, and other health organizations. Scott Gordon, the executive vice president of Arkansas Children's Hospital, says significant strides have been made in areas like injury prevention and oral health.
We've seen a dramatic reduction in the teen deaths by automobile, so that's exciting. We also have seen an improvement in the number of children whose teeth are sealed.
Gordon says over the past 5 years, the number of children ages 6 to 9 who have dental sealants to protect their teeth from decay has increased by 12%. But Gordon notes the state needs to tackle a continuing obesity epidemic and a high infant mortality rate, as well as work on improving access to mental health services.
Mercy Northwest Arkansas yesterday broke ground on a new clinic in Centerton. The 7,300-square-foot facility will be located on Highway 102 on 6.2 acres of commercial frontage property donated by John L. Hunt. The $3 million facility will have 2 internal medicine and 2 pediatric physicians, 1 family medicine doctor, and 2 family medicine nurse practitioners. The facility will also feature rotating specialties such as cardiology, endocrinology, and diabetic education based on the community's needs. The facility is expected to open later this year.
The city of Bentonville is giving away compost and wood mulch next week. From Tuesday through Saturday, residents can stop by the city's compost facility on Northwest A Street during normal business hours to receive free wood mulch. According to the city, a skid steer loader and operator will be available to load pickup trucks and trailers, while those without a pickup or trailer will need to bring their own containers and a shovel.
Tyson Foods has named a new head for its Mexico operations. Yesterday, the company announced the promotion of Rick Thomason as president and general manager of Tyson de Mexico. Thomason has been with Tyson Foods since 1991 and has held various roles in the company's accounting and finance group since that time. Before his promotion, he served as Vice President of Accounting for Tyson's international businesses.
The University of Arkansas's College of Engineering has improved its national standing. According to the university, the college was ranked 66th among public research universities in the most recent ranking of best graduate schools by U.S. News & World Reports. That's an improvement of three places from last year's ranking. Also listed in the graduate school rankings was the Master's of Business Administration program in the Walton College of Business. The MBA program ranks number one in the nation in terms of percentage of students employed upon graduation. 88% of Walton MBA students have jobs upon graduation. U.S. News also ranked the program 30th overall among public business schools.
Mostly cloudy tonight with lows from 40 in northwest Arkansas to 48 in the Arkansas River Valley. Cloudy tomorrow with a 70% chance of showers and a high near 64 in northwest Arkansas, and an 80% chance of showers and thunderstorms and a high of 66 in the Arkansas River Valley. Tomorrow night, there is an 80% chance of showers and thunderstorms with lows from 43 to 49.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellens. With me on the phone from Fort Smith is Michael Tilley, who is the editor and publisher of thecitywire.com that covers news, politics, business, culture, and more for the entire listening area. And a pleasant Friday to you, sir.
Well, and a good Friday back at you. Glad to have you back in the region.
Well, good to be back. It was a nice trip to the Bay Area, at least nice for me. Baseball team lost 3 of 4, but it's good to be back.
Baseball was not very, very good for us.
they'll bounce back in Gainesville, yes. Florida this week, I'm sure.
Okay.
All right. Well, let's talk about bouncing a little bit further into the future for the Marshalls Museum in Fort Smith. This is, of course, quite the endeavor, and now the opening is going to be a little bit later than had been earlier announced.
Right. It's, you know, they still say they're going to break ground this September, which is the 225th. Anniversary of the U.S. Marshals Service, one of the longest-serving federal agencies, you know, was created by George Washington. But the museum, the opening will be delayed. You know, it's they have had a tough time. This thing was announced back in 2007, and they are just having a tough time raising the money for what is, depending on which number you see, $50 to maybe $55 million project. And that's, you know, it's frustrating for us, the public, because, you know, there are a lot of us that would love to see it. It'd be a great catalyst for downtown Fort Smith. But I can't imagine how frustrating it is also for that staff, that Marshalls Museum staff and the board who are having to see this through. But hopefully they have some money coming in, and, you know, there'll be no more delays. You know, when it was first announced, there was kind of a hope. No one ever said anything, but there was a hope that, you know, within 5 to 7 years would be opening this thing up, which would have been, you know, 2012 or now. But it looks like it's going to be another 2 to 3 years, and it's frustrating. These things happen. Frankly, I've been surprised. It's, you know, it's a U.S. Marshals, it's a national museum. It's a long history, like I said, since, you know, 225 years. I'm somewhat surprised that there hasn't been that money come up to fund this. But now we just get to watch a few more years.
$50 to $55 million is not chump change.
No, it's not chump change. But, you know, I mean, I guess maybe we in Arkansas are a little spoiled. Or, you know, Crystal Bridges, you know, when you have an Alice Walton backing something, it gets funded pretty quickly. The Clinton Library was well funded and fast, and so I guess maybe we've seen a few of these museums, a few of these centers, you know, move pretty quickly, and it might have been faulty on my, you know, for me to have the assumption that this could possibly do the same.
In 2012, there was a ballot issue that all Arkansans voted on about medicinal marijuana. And it surprised many pundits by almost passing. I think it was nearly 49% in favor. Some of the very same people who authored that amendment are back, and they're confident.
yes, they're confident. In fact, the PR person, Melissa Fultz, says that, you know, she thinks that it could be a shoe-in, that they'll win by a wide margin. Now, I'm not sure it'll be a wide margin, but I would not be surprised if they win. You know, think about this conservative area that, you know, your market and our market, the citywide market, you know, that Benton, Washington, Crawford, Sebastian County. If you add up the total votes for medical marijuana in the last election, it passed in those four counties. It received 51.5%. Now, if you do a county breakdown, it did not pass in Benton County and it did not pass in Crawford, but it passed in Washington and Sebastian County. But that is a very politically and religious part of the state in terms of voter, in terms of conservative voters, social issue voters. And it passed 51 to 51.5%. And, you know, think about it, Kyle, the attitudes that have changed just in the 2 years. You know, we've seen levels of legalization in Washington State and Colorado, and we've not seen some of the negatives that everyone thought. What happens in, you know, the Pew Trust polls and several other polls are showing a wider acceptance among likely voters of, you know, some form of legalized marijuana. So I think if they get their signatures and if they get a good campaign, and they get a well-funded campaign, I am not going to be surprised to see Arkansas be one of the first southern states to approve medical marijuana.
Because it was such a close vote last time, don't you think there will be some more better organized opposition? Because that didn't really seem to develop in 2012.
No, it didn't. And that is a great point, Kyle. You know, in 2012, some law enforcement agencies and some church groups and a few of the groups that you would expect to come out against it, you know, put out statements and, you know, just thought, well, that's enough. And it really, you know, I talked to some of those officials, especially law enforcement officials, and they were just shocked that it was that close. And I did hear some of them say, you know, well, this comes up on the ballot again, we'll have to take it seriously. But even with that, I think enough people now see that. Nonsense was the word I was about to use, and I'm not sure that may be too strong, but, you know, they look at, you know, tobacco, nicotine is legal, and alcohol is legal, and I think people are more educated about marijuana and about, you know, these type of social issues, and I think there's more of a libertarian element among the population now in terms of social issues, and so, you know, I think you're right. I think those anti-groups are going to come out a little bit harder, but I think momentum may be on the pro-marijuana side.
And again, this is medicinal marijuana.
Yes.
As opposed to just the decriminalization or recreational use.
And, right. Yeah, this doesn't go near where the Colorado law.
Right.
And you're correct. It's just medicinal. And as we move further in the year, we're going to learn more about what, you know, the specifics of this amendment, you know, what's it mean, how you can get it, and in the story we have on the CityWire, there are already some of those details in terms of provisions within the amendment.
We thought there was going to be a union vote at OK Foods in 2013. It didn't happen. Looks like there will be one in 2014?
Yes, there will be, and this is interesting. I think this is a function of, you know, if we remember, OK Foods was purchased a couple of years ago by a company out of Mexico, and that company had a union affiliation, so it was only a matter of time before that union, that UFCW, it's one of the unions, it's also after United Food and Commercial Workers, also after Walmart, but they're hoping to unionize and there's several thousand OK Foods employees at their Fort Smith facilities and some of their eastern Oklahoma facilities, and they had scheduled a vote last year, and then there was a complication. There was a mix-up. That's the best answer we get. We'll stick with it for now. But mix-up between OK Foods and the union and the National Labor Relations Board to some extent about how many people could vote, how many employers there were. So they had to reschedule the election. So that'll happen later this year. And if that goes on, if UFCW pushes this, it'll, you know, often these elections get a little heated, get a little tense, so it will be this will definitely be something we'll watch with interest through the rest of the year.
All right. Michael Tilley is the editor and publisher of thecitywire.com that covers business, news, politics, culture, and much more for the entire listening area. Michael, thank you so much for your time.
All right, Kyle. Have a good weekend.
Ahead on Ozarks at Large, a personal collection goes public at Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art.
And unlike in the past, where you have had to go from these galleries over to our permanent collection to see, let's say in this case, our modernist masters, you don't have to do that this time. All you have to do is go one room over. We've brought them here so you can have the opportunity for the first time at Crystal Bridges to directly compare the European masters of modernism and the American artists that were inspired by their work.
The William S. Paley Collection gives patrons a taste of modernism through midsummer. We'll have a preview in about 12 minutes on Ozarks at Large.
Hi, my name is Paul, your host for the Generic Blue Show, which airs every Friday night at 9 o'clock. Join me this Friday. I brought in Roger Plourd, the Ozark Blues Society president. He talks about the 2014 Blues in the Natural State, happening April 3rd, 4th, and 5th. Headlining the festival this year, Tab Benoit, Royal Southern Brotherhood, featuring Devin Allman, Cyril Neville, and Mike Zito, Samantha Fish, the Cape Brothers, RJ Michaud, and more. Hear about it this Friday night on the Generic Blues Show. We'll see you then.
This is Ozarks at Large. Centerton High School, Bentonville West, or Bentonville Alliance, just three of the many names students and teachers voted on for the new high school to be built in the Bentonville School District. An official name will be set by the school board next week. Earlier this week, the district held an open house to unveil its plans for the new high school, whatever the eventual name. A diverse crowd of about 80 stakeholders, including senior citizens, parents, and students, attended the event. It was led by the superintendent, as well as members of the project design team. Ozarks at Large's Christina Thomas met with the superintendent the day after the presentation, and she has this report.
From a couch inside his second-story corner office at the Bentonville School District's administration building on Tiger Boulevard, Superintendent Michael Poor says he is quite pleased with the turnout Monday evening. He says part of the enthusiasm from the community is due to the fact that a new high school has been discussed since about the turn of the 21st century. And since then, has been a large part of the community dialogue.
That I think that, first and foremost, creates that intrigue about what will this look like now. Second, a lot of people really put support towards a second high school because they wanted to have greater opportunities for students. They wanted to have two student councils. They wanted to have two different choirs, two different basketball teams, all those type of dynamics. And so they really wanted to visualize and really see that, in fact, we'll have two quality high schools now as a part of the Bentonville school system.
The community has been for the concept of a second high school for years, but turned out to show that support in September 2013 when it voted with a 70% approval rating to fund construction. The concept won in every precinct in the district. Poor also credits a trust level within the district because they handled a millage passed in 2010 so well. That vote resulted in the building of a junior high school, middle school, and an elementary. They added on to existing schools and had enhancements to technology. The first step for this project was to put together a project design team.
Their first target that they established was that they wanted to have a school that would be collaborative in nature. We feel like that is really the trend in education, to allow children to collaborate with each other, student to student, to have student-to-teacher collaboration, and then teacher-to-teacher collaboration. And so the spaces and the flow of the building really highlights that, to offer those type of opportunities. We know that collaboration really means that kids are diving into the work and that they are being creative and innovative and project-based in terms of the type of delivery. And so we believe that this design is going to enhance that opportunity.
Officials say the learning at the new high school will be less like a grocery store and more like a kitchen. Plans for the new school show each department, like math, social studies, science, and English, in a pod of its own. Classrooms are set up along the perimeter of each pod, with a shared learning or career pathways space in the middle. Teachers will also have a work area.
As an example, in a science lab, you might have the med prep type lab, and it will be very visual, so kids can be looking into that lab and seeing the things. We hope that spurs kids to want to maybe look into that type of approach or be a part of it. On the other end of it, We will have things like a cooking lab that actually will have kids leaving that lab with certification to be a part of culinary-type programs.
Poor says academics in Bentonville have always been stressed and believe these new academic spaces will create an opportunity for project-based learning and promote the aforementioned collaboration. The building will be two stories and shaped like an L, with the inside of the L facing the street.
There's kind of like three anchors in each of the ends or in the middle of the L. One anchor on one of the ends of the L, so to speak, is Performing Arts Center. On the other end of that L is Athletic. And then where the L joins, okay, at that corner, if you want to look at it that way, that's really where the entrance of the school is and the cafeteria, the social place of where our kids will interact.
Not just the district, but also other organizations have been criticized for building Taj Mahals in Bentonville. But Poor says you won't see this here. As with the other buildings constructed by the district since 2010, he says it will be a quality building, a source of pride, and not over the top, with a positive use of square footage. The ideal capacity for the new school is 2,250. Ideal capacity meaning that which a school is functioning at its very best.
Our current high school's ideal capacity is 3,700, yet we know that we have 4,200 kids in the building right now. So, Is the current high school not functioning well? No, but it's crowded. So we've exceeded the ideal capacity and we're still functioning.
Poor says that numbers have yet to be determined, but projects the high school to open with about 1,500 students, while allowing it to grow gradually each year in response to the growing community to the south and west sides of the district. A team and construction management approach was utilized in the design to accommodate all of these students.
Which really means that our idea is that we want to have our folks, our school district and folks, working with a contractor and then working with an architectural team. And all three of them are working together and holding each other accountable and making sure that, you know, we don't go over budget and that we also create a design that's going to really be suitable for this type of learning environment.
The architecture firm is the local company Height Jackson, in addition to the firm DLR out of Kansas City and Flint & Co. Poor says the teams work almost like a triangle to facilitate talking and thinking and sort of check one another's ideas. The new high school will be located on Gamble Road in Centerton on 90 acres and where the district already has an elementary school. Bentonville School District actually encompasses nine different communities, including parts of Springdale, Rogers, Cave Springs, Centerton, and Bella Vista, though official boundaries have yet to be drawn for this new high school.
My recommendation to the board has been for us to do a boundary study over the course of the summer and then try to share that in early next fall. And really, we'd probably do a boundary that would encompass not just for the new high school, but for all of our schools, because we're in need of tweaking that boundary as we grow and the community keeps on expanding.
They also hope to break ground this summer, as early as July, with classes beginning in August of 2016. The school board hopes to announce an official name and mascot next week. Mascots could be Wolverines, Jaguars, Falcons, Diamond Cutters, and Barracudas. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Christina Thomas.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
With us, Becca Martin Brown, features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
You know, every once in a while, that thing you and I have about how fast time flies bites you.
Yeah?
I had one of those weeks where I looked up and went, no, this is the first weekend in March. Oh, no, it's not.
We're mid-March already.
Uh-oh.
I know.
So
many things.
Since it's that time of the month, it's time for
St. Patrick's Day.
St. Patrick's Day. Everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Everywhere. Starting with the McCafferty Irish Dancers at Storytime tomorrow at the Fayetteville Public Library at 10:30. St. Patrick's Day on the Hill, which includes a parade, the Arkansas Stout Brewing Championship, music and performances. The parade starts at 11 tomorrow, and there's a craft beer village on the Fayetteville Square from 2 to 6.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
Looking forward to it.
St. Patrick's Day weekend at the Mill, at War Eagle Mill, outside of Rogers. It includes food, traditional Celtic and American music by the Mudlarks, Irish and Scottish music by Patty O'Grill and Bill O'Sale. That's 11 to 3 on Saturday and 11 to 3 on Sunday, and there's a leprechaun treasure hunt.
Where does this take place?
This is at War Eagle Mill.
Okay.
If you get a leprechaun, what do you do with it?
Don't you get a pot of gold or something? Isn't that the
Ooh.
Thing? Right?
But what do you do with the leprechaun?
You make him take you to his pot of gold.
And then what do you do with the leprechaun?
Then you let him,
invite him over.
You let him go.
Invite him over. Bring some beer. The 21st Annual St. Patty Parade starts at 2 o'clock tomorrow in Eureka Springs. And the Luck of the Irish train ride and dinner.
Oh, fun.
A four-hour sunset tour from Springdale to Winslow with dinner on board the Arkansas and Missouri Railroad.
Sounds like a lot of fun.
Leaves at 4 o'clock tomorrow from Springdale. Find out more at amrailroad.com. The St. Pat's Eve Bash at Mickey Finn's on Sunday evening mm-hmm. with music by Patty O'Grill. And on Monday from 5 to 8 at the Rowdy Beaver in Eureka Springs, Patty O'Grill and Bill O'Sale will be playing.
Well, I mean, this is like Valentine's Day, right, for Patty O'Grill. I mean,
oh, sure.
This is the big weekend.
And there's a St. Patrick's Day celebration on the 22nd, just in case you're running late like I am. At 2 o'clock at the Springdale Public Library, you can come dressed in green, hear some music by the Ozark Highlanders Pipe Band, and do an Irish-inspired craft.
All right.
I'll be there catching up. Also this weekend, you know who Coleman Ray Clark is, right?
Yes, love him.
Isn't he awesome?
Mm-hmm.
He's got his own theater company.
He does, which is ridiculous.
It is ridiculous. He's still in high school.
I know.
As are his colleagues. And so this is their second season.
Mm-hmm.
And this weekend they are doing something called Completely Hollywood, which is everything about Hollywood, the 186 greatest films in Hollywood in about 90 minutes.
So it's one of those kind of abridged things where you cram mm-hmm. everything into a hour and a half show.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Which you know he'll be hilarious at. Mm-hmm. Reed Carson's part of it. This is 7 o'clock today, 2 and 7 tomorrow, and 2 on Sunday at the Fayetteville High School Black Box Theater. Tickets are $8 for students. He points out that's any student of any school. And $10 for adults.
The School of Life? Could you get away with that?
Does it come with an ID card?
That.
That's a good question.
It does. It's a driver's license.
That's right.
Also this weekend, Sideways Stories from Wayside School, where learning is magical. At 7 o'clock today, 2 and 7 tomorrow, and 2 on Sunday at Arts Live Theater in Fayetteville, Skola Cantorum is doing a farewell concert.
Because they're going to head to Puerto Rico, correct?
Exactly. Not because it's farewell to Skola Cantorum. Mm-hmm. Just see you later. We're going to Puerto Rico.
A bon voyage, sort of.
Yes.
Yeah.
7:30 today at First United Methodist Church in Rogers and 7:30 tomorrow at University Baptist Church in Fayetteville. And you can find out more from Stephen Caldwell, their director, at Stephen C., that's P-H, S-T-E-P-H-E-N-C at uark.edu. And this weekend is the wrap-up of Chicago the Musical at the Walton Arts Center. 8 o'clock today, 2 and 8 tomorrow, and 2 on Sunday. Quite possibly the musical with the least heroic options
yeah.
of any yeah. musical I can think
true.
Of.
Very true.
Tickets start at $39 at 443-5600.
All right. Thank you, Becca.
Becca Martin Brown is features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
No matter what you see, I don't always get excited about every show. I'm excited about this show all the way to my toes for a lot of reasons, and I want to tell you a few of them so that they can inform the conversations that you have with our curatorial team throughout the rest of your morning.
Yesterday morning, Nikki Stewart, Director of Education and Exhibitions at Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art, talked to a small group of media and other guests about her excitement for a new temporary exhibit. The William S. Paley Collection, A Taste for Modernism, which opens to the public tomorrow, was organized by the Museum of Modern Art in New York and features more than 60 works of art that range from paintings to drawings to sculptures. The collection has been on a North American tour since 2012, and this is its last stop before the pieces are returned to their home at MoMA. This exhibition contains works by European masters of modernism like Degas and Matisse. Most of the art pieces are similar in size, but one notable exception is Pablo Picasso's Boy Leading a Horse. The painting measures more than 7 feet tall and 4 feet wide. A complimentary exhibition titled The European Connection is located a few steps away in another room of the same gallery. This exhibit includes works by Stuart Davis and Arthur Dove, as well as 3 pieces from Alfred Henry Maurer that have not been on view in the museum.
And unlike in the past, where you have had to go from these galleries over to our permanent collection to see, let's say in this case, our modernist masters, you don't have to do that this time. All you have to do is go one room over. We've brought them here so you can have the opportunity for the first time at Crystal Bridges to directly compare the European masters of modernism and the American artists that were inspired by their work. You can see it directly, and the line between the two becomes clearer and clearer with every time you visit.
Most of the artworks in the exhibition were created between 1880 and 1940 at the height of French modernism. All selections come from the private collection of William S. Paley, the late founder of CBS. Paley was also an active trustee at the Museum of Modern Art. He joined its board in 1937, only 8 years after the museum's inception. He rose through the ranks and earned the title of president, chairman, and chairman emeritus. Paley began buying art in the mid-1930s and continued to do so until the early 70s. Upon his death in 1990, at the age of 86, Paley willed his entire collection to the museum. According to a news release, Paley selected works based on his personal taste rather than for investment purposes. For that reason, several of his works were smaller, which made them suitable for the walls of his New York apartment, where most of the works resided throughout his life. Manuela Welloffman, assistant curator at Crystal Bridges, says this influenced her decision to create partial walls and columns in the gallery so guests can have an intimate encounter with the art.
Mr. Paley traveled to Europe during the 1930s and selected artworks he had a personal connection to, and often these works were modest size, small size, so to present these smaller size artworks in an aesthetic way, I thought one can do that by creating those smaller niches, small rooms, as if you stand in a living room and enjoy these wonderful artworks.
Several of these columns and partial walls contain yellow letters spelling out the names of artists found in that particular area of the gallery. The walls themselves have been painted a bluish-gray color. Welloffman says she wanted a warm, darker color for this exhibit to really emphasize the vibrant colors these modernists were using at the time. When comparing the European and American artists, guests can find similarities in things like bright colors. Welloffman points to Marsden Hartley's Mountains No. 22 as an example. Hartley painted this work in 1930 after he returned from a long stay in Europe. The scene depicts the White Mountains of New Hampshire. A bright blue sky with fluffy white clouds hovers over the large mountains, which take up the majority of the canvas and contain green, red, and golden hues.
You will see those patches of color, and you will find that also in Cézanne's classic landscapes. So individual brushstrokes, distinctive brushstrokes, parallel to next to each other. This is something Marston Hartley definitely picked up from Paul Cézanne, and the colors are different here. This is a mountain scene he actually painted in America, so it's an American landscape, and this is so beautiful. You see those American artists visiting Paris and get inspired by these great European modernists, and then they come back to America and really develop their own style of modernism. They are inspired by certain things like technique or colors or the motif, but then they do the creative thing, they develop their own modernism. Style.
The William S. Paley Collection, A Taste for Modernism, will open to the public tomorrow. The exhibition will remain on view through July 7th. Admission is $8 for adults. Admission to all temporary exhibits is free for museum members and for guests 18 years old and younger. More information is available at crystalbridges.org.
Hello, I'm Robert Ginsberg, your host for Shades of Jazz every Friday and Saturday night from 10 till midnight. On this Friday edition of Shades of Jazz, I'll pay tribute to the great Belgian harmonica player and composer Toots Thielemans, probably best known for his film score work. He did the soundtrack for Midnight Cowboy. We'll also hear from Marcus Roberts and Matt Wilson, the Yellow Jackets, Woody Shaw, and much more. That's Shades of Jazz this Friday at 10 p.m.
This is Ozarks at Large. Last week, Downtown Bentonville Incorporated debuted its new Notes at Night series. In keeping with the Irish theme of its first Friday event, the organization hosted a few out-of-town Irish musicians. One of those bands was Finvarra's Wren. The Detroit-based quartet features Jim Perkins and Cheryl Burns Perkins, as well as their children Allison and Asher. Last Saturday, Jim, Cheryl, and Allison stopped by the Furman Garner Performance Studio. During our conversation, Jim explained the meaning behind the group's name.
Finvarra is the king of the fairies in old Irish mythologies. And a wren band is a band that is usually formed just specifically to play on St. Stephen's Day, the day after Christmas. And that's an old tradition throughout Europe, but it really hung on in Ireland, I think, longer than anywhere else. And in the old days, kids would go out and try to hunt a wren, and then they would have a mock funeral for the wren and gather pennies all day long. It was kind of like trick-or-treat, but with a wren in a box. But it's impossible to kill a wren because they're so fast and little, so they usually have like a stuffed effigy of a wren. But after a while, they just decided that was all silly, and they just played music and danced and sang, and they went door-to-door and did that instead. So that's a wren band. And so wren bands are usually designated for whatever village they come from. And since we didn't have a village in particular, we just decided to put Finvarra on the front of it. So that's how we became Finvarra's Wren. So we figured if we were just Finvarra, there'd be a dozen bands out there called that. Or if it was just a wren band, there'd be a bunch of them. But so far, we're the only Finvarra's Wren.
Okay.
We can see.
Maybe you should put a copyright on that while you got the chance.
Yeah, really. Registered.
Yes, yes. So did you grow up with a lot of Irish folklore? Is that how you knew of that? Or did you sort of go looking for Irish
stories?
Well,
kind of both.
Mm-hmm. It's real available in our community. We have a lot of Irish players. There are always triad players. We have a Gaelic league there, which is a club that, you know, preserves and protects the Irish language and some of the culture, and there are other groups. So there was always music available, and, you know, for many years, but especially, I think, since about the 60s on, there was, and certainly when they were growing up. You know, Irish sessions are a kind of common thing all over the world, and you have Irish musicians who show up together for just the common reason of playing music together. You know, they always hold like a lot of tunes in common that no matter where you go to a session, there will be some tunes in common and you just sit and play them. So we always went to those and took the kids to those as they were growing up.
Yeah, it's very social music.
Very social.
Well, what attracted you to Irish music as musicians?
Well, I was a folky and I got a job playing in an Irish pub. And I learned a few of the standard pub songs and I wasn't all that impressed with it, but it was a gig, you know. But then the guy who owned the pub had this great collection of recorded music, and on the breaks he'd be playing this stuff, and I would be listening. And I go, boy, I thought that's better than what I'm singing. So I would always be asking. It was Tom O'Halloran was his name. And I always said, Tommy, who's that? Who's that? So he'd be telling me, oh, that's Planxty, or that's the Chieftains, or whoever. So that was my first exposure to traditional music. And I started learning bits of that. I worked with a whistle player from Belfast named Noel Lenihan. Taught me to play some tin whistle, and kind of, you know, little by little, you get dragged onto the path, you know.
When I say Irish music, am I incorrect? Because I feel like if I said American music, well, there's all kinds of different types of American music.
There are
say,
different types of Irish music. You know, like there's the stuff that you hear when you go to a pub, for instance, you know, and that's more like kind of folky Irish music, at least the way I think of it. And then what I do, like as a fiddle player, like I think of that, like I'm playing like the diddly diddly like tunes, you know, which you wouldn't hear as much in just a bar. So there are kind of different genres, and I think of our band as kind of a mix of the folky side and the traditional side, you know, because we have the tunes and the songs, so... But yeah, it's all just Irish music, too.
I assume that there were different types of genres. Yeah. And when I say Irish music, I was always wondering, do I need to say traditional? Or?
Right. It's kind of similar to, you know, you could say American music, but then there's also old time, there's bluegrass, you know, there's blues, there's all these, like, different genres in a larger genre. So
sometimes in Irish music, in fact, right before we left, somebody had a post up on someone's Facebook, and they were arguing about what is Irish music, and I see that argument like every
people have trouble agreeing.
Because sometimes Irish rock bands get pulled into that, and they may consider themselves Irish rock, but other people put it under the heading of Irish traditional, and so you have all of these arguments over the finer points.
Yeah,
that's a real sticking point. What really means, what does traditional mean, you know, because it means different things to different people. Some people think a tradition is when Irish eyes are smiling, because that's what they grew up hearing, so that's their tradition, you know. When we think tradition, we think old tunes, jigs and reels, and unaccompanied songs, when somebody's singing with a finger in their ear, you know, stuff like that. Yeah.
Well, how do you guys select your songs, or do you have originals as well?
We have a mix. You know, my dad, Jim, is actually a great songwriter, so we incorporate some of his originals into our music. But also we do just traditional songs that nobody knows who wrote them, or, you know, and so we do those. And the tunes are kind of the same. Like, most of them are probably traditional, and by that I mean they're old and we don't know, you know, who the original composer was. But we also do some of our own original tunes and some that our friends have written, and, you know, so we kind of just, we do whatever we like, basically. You know, we don't have, like, rules or anything of what we pick, but, yeah, so...
We try to avoid the actual covers.
Yeah, we try to. We do try to pick things that are more obscure, maybe that people won't have just heard everybody doing. So, but
so when we get to a festival, we're not the third band to do that song.
Right. Day, you
know?
Yeah.
Well, with Irish music, you have some different instruments. I recognize Allison's fiddle, and I recognize Jim's guitar. But another instrument you guys were tuning before we started talking, I don't know what that is.
Okay. If I was tuning it, it's probably the dulcimer.
Okay.
Which, actually, this dulcimer was made here, was it not?
Yeah,
in Arkansas.
Arkansas instrument there.
Dulcimer, which is the dulcimer maker down here, I believe. But the other instrument that I have is the boron. Rhymes with moron, but don't drum.
And was that the drum?
That's the drum. Mine is blue. Usually they're not blue, but I wanted a blue one. And it's an instrument that traditionally has a goatskin head on it. And when Jim was talking about the Wren bands, that's one of the instruments they probably went through the town banging on, but they would have just, you know, blatantly been banging on it and maybe playing some whistle or some fiddle. And it's evolved. The playing style has evolved a lot in the last 30 years.
So why a blue one? And was that difficult to find someone to make you a blue one?
Well, we bought it for her as a Christmas gift, so it was actually our decision. But our friend Albert Alfonso actually made the drum, and he's a great drum maker in Texas. And she wanted one of his drums, and so we contacted him before Christmas, and we said, all right, well, we want to buy her a drum. And he said, well, I have a blue one if you want that one, and if you want a different color, it's going to take longer. So we said, all right, blue it is. So, but it sounds great, you know.
It fits my personality.
I actually think it's pretty,
drum.
Too.
No, it's gorgeous. I thought it was quite lovely.
I have seven drums or so, and it's my favorite one. So.
Seven drums?
Something like that.
Did they each make a different sound? Do they each have a different purpose?
They are. One of them is very, very old drum. It's older than I am, actually, which is pretty old, that a friend of mine left me. He was moving back to Ireland, and he had gone back and forth and was afraid the drum was going to crack. So he just said, I have a bad feeling about this. I'm not going to take this with me this time. I'm going to give it to you. So, and it's a cool drum, but it's fragile, so I don't usually bring that one out.
Well, how old are the fiddle and the guitar? They look a little worn.
Yeah, my fiddle is from the 1880s.
That's what I wonder.
And I got it, I received it from my parents because my dad got it from this guy he used to play with when my dad was probably my age, you know, in his 20s. And he was in, like, this little pickup band with this, the front man was named Al Arsenal, and he was, like, a bluegrass fiddle player, but he also was a trick fiddle player. So he'd, like, play behind his back and stuff and under his leg and, you know, be kind of crazy. And so my dad was like, you know, like, I've always wanted to play the fiddle. Like, I think that would be really fun. And Al said, well, you know, I'll give you one of my extra ones. So, you know, I have a ton of them. So I just gave my dad this fiddle. And my dad kind of half-heartedly tried to learn, and I think
I was into it, but people kept hiding the fiddle.
Yeah, my mom ended up hiding it because fiddle sounds really bad when you're learning. You know, it's like it's not fun to be around. So for years and years, you know, the fiddle just sat in the attic, and like Al passed away, and they tried to give the fiddle back, and his wife was like, "Oh no, I have a ton of them, just keep it." You know, so when I came along and I expressed interest in learning to play the fiddle, they were like, "Well, we have that fiddle up in the attic. Like, I wonder if we could get that fixed up and if it's any good." And it ended up that it was like a pretty nice instrument. And so, you know, that's the fiddle I kind of learned to play on, and I still play it to this day. And it's, you know, it's got a lot of personality, and it's a part of me, and, you know, so I like it. So, yeah. How old is the guitar?
And this old guitar, it's a Martin D28. It was made in 1965, and I bought it used when I was 18 years old, so it's my oldest friend. And it's a lovely old box. It's all old and beat up, but that's okay, so am I. And we're getting along pretty good.
Well, we've been talking about your instruments and your music for a while. Would you like to play something for me?
Sure. Yeah.
I would be happy to. Okay. So we're going to do a song that was written by our friend Jimmy Crowley, who considers himself the voice of Cork. That's what it says on his answering machine when you call him up. Ah, he reached the voice of Cork. And he's a character. We met him in Mississippi, in Jackson, Mississippi, at the Celtic Fest there a few years ago. And I got along great. And then he was playing in Michigan. He came through, and he was playing a concert in Saginaw, which is a couple hours north of us near Detroit, there where we live. So Cheryl and I went up to hear him. And he did an evening pretty much of all original songs. And we were very impressed with his writing. And at one point he sang this song. Cheryl and I both turned to each other at the end of the song and whispered, "We got to steal that." So we did. So this is Jimmy Crowley's song. It's a love song for a sailing vessel. It's called My Love is a Tall Ship.
Ready?
One. My love is a tall ship, a sweet brigantine. One of the old girls, seldom now seen. And she heaves to the wind, boys. See how she glides, with stars in her hair and mist in her eyes. My love is a tall ship, no finer was seen. For many is the ocean my true love has been. And the wind in the rigging whispers her name, while grace on the bow watches over the main. Though your breezes blow, fair wind to the Asgard, dark rolling sea, all on the sheets, girls, pick up the downfall. Step on the yards, lads, mind you don't fall. Stand by to brace, boys, unfurl the topsail, and we'll soon make it home. Billowing
Fair wind to the Asgard. Watch it, lady, go o'er the dark rolling sea. My love is a tall ship, a sweet brigantine. One of the old girls seldom now seen. And she heaves to the wind, boys. See how she glides with stars in her hair and mist in her eyes.
That was Jim, Cheryl, and Allison Perkins, three members of the Irish music quartet Finvarra's Wren. You can hear more from our conversation Sunday morning at 9 on Weekend Ozarks at Large. For music, performance dates, and more, visit Finvarra's Wren. That's Finvarras and Wren, Wren, .com.
There was an 11-year-old girl in Illinois, and she opened up a cupcake stand right in front of her house. And then
the authorities shut her down because she needed to either buy a bakery or build a separate kitchen under the health code.
Stories like this one might tell us a lot about our broken legal system. Solving the big problems, that's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Listen Sunday at noon to 91.3 FM.
A listener-supported service of the Department of Journalism and Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, Alma.
And it will be St. Patrick's Day weekend.
Sure.
I think there are more St. Patrick's Day-themed things happening around here than ever before.
It's been growing, for sure. I know the Fayetteville Parade, I think this is its third year.
And Eureka's been doing theirs for a while.
For a while. Mm-hmm. I know Fort Smith has celebrations, so lots of St. Patrick's Day things happening throughout the region. Of course, I know there's a chance for rain, so how that alters plans, I'm not quite sure. So check with your event organizers, as always, to see what the plan is in case of rain. I don't know if I want to say inclement weather, because I feel like rain isn't quite... Inclement weather, I think, is something a little more heinous.
To me, inclement weather is weather that provides a danger to you being outside. Hailstorms, okay. Windstorms.
So thunderstorm, lightning.
Yes. Oh, definitely.
Lightning, yeah. Okay.
But showers, no.
No.
Could be inclement to your laptop.
It's inconvenient.
Yes, it's very inconvenient. But and also tomorrow, weather permitting, I suppose, the celebration of the end of winter, holy, at Wilson Park.
Mm-hmm. That's always a lot of fun.
Colorful.
Colorful. It is very colorful. It's the university organizations that are involved with that do a good job. You come out and get to this like powdered paint that's all different colors. You get to throw it at people. That's the best holiday ever. I don't know who came up with this like back in the day in India, but fabulous. Thumbs up. Celebrating light and all of that.
What clothes should you wear? Something that you don't mind having powdered color on?
Right. I mean, I think anymore most of that stuff is washable.
Sure.
But just in case.
You wouldn't have your tux.
Wear something you're not worried about if the paint doesn't come out.
Right.
I had no problem with it when I participated.
If you're going to a Saturday in the park,
Would you wear a tux anyway?
Exactly.
And I don't know. Can't run in a tux. So.
No, you cannot. You shouldn't.
You can, but yes, I don't recommend it.
Ozarks at Large, a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
Christina Thomas and I will have Weekend Ozark Sunday morning at 9. Thanks so much for listening.